June 21st, 2020. Happy Father's Day. Chicken has been brining for 2 days and is currently in the smoker. Grace and Anna are making some homemade mac and cheese. Gotta admit it though, missing me some US Open. No Tiger, no Phil. With the exception of no Cardinal season opener, this is really the most I've missed sports since this whole mess hit. MU football in 10 weekends, he says with fingers crossed. FaceTimed with thing one and thing two after breakfast, doing the same with mom and dad, and later outside 6 feet apart with the in-laws. Looking forward to the day. Had a busy night last night, shredding all the unused Trump rally tickets I bought. Three things you should if you have not. First, a beautiful day in the neighborhood. Tom Hanks, great as always, this time playing the Mr. Rogers. Based on a true story of a real-life friendship Rogers had with journalist Tom Junod, if I pronounce that right. Junod is played by Matthew Rhimes from the FX show The Americans. Man, has he found his lane. I don't get HBO, but I might if his upcoming series Perry Mason is as good as it looks. Number two, if you listen to any other podcast than mine this week, go out and check out last week's talk between Mark Maron and Joe Pantoliano, or Joey Pants, as he is called. You might know Joey from vehicles like Risky Business, The Fugitive, and Sopranos, which he has never seen. We've got aunts that were actually mothers, addictions, great behind-the-scene movie stories, worth the 90 minutes, as was my talk this week with Jim Thomas, debuting soon, but I digress. Maron and Joey Pants on Maron's fantastic podcast, WTF. Lastly, Korean barbecue wings. Wow, what a treat. Today's guest, Moon Suk Soo, is best known for bringing sushi to the masses in St. Louis with his Drunken Fish locations, and now he is bringing kimchi hard on the landing. If you can't make it downtown a lot, call your favorite delivery person, company. Don't sleep on these wings. I went traditional and spicy, going garlic butter next time. We had never met, but Moon Suk sure seems like a guy who loves his life. Go check out a St. Louis 7 episode on YouTube on our OT with Oliver channel. In this episode, we talk about him moving from Seoul with his family at 6, how his clientele has evolved over the last 2 decades, and towards the end, how COVID has caused him to pivot and even come up with some new ways, maybe some better ways, on how to run his restaurants. If you are not a fan of sushi, you will soon and still be a fan of Moon Suk Soo.
Go to Overtime. Overtime with Oliver, with my dad. Tell your friends.
And welcome to the next edition of Overtime with Oliver, the podcast that documents all important people, places, and things in St. Louis's past and future. And it's probably really hard to do a podcast about that kind of thing in St. Louis if you don't have a chance to sit down and talk to Moon Suk Soo, president and CEO of So Hospitality Group. Thanks for making the time. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So let's start at the beginning, if you will. Like a few of my other guests, you were not born in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Born in Seoul.
I was born in Seoul, South Korea, yeah, but I came over when I was 6 years old. So I don't remember too much of Korea, but yeah, most of my life I've lived here, actually in St. Louis. So I feel like I'm a St. Louisan. Love the city of St. Louis. It's my hometown.
Why the move?
My older sister has muscular dystrophy. Back then, we didn't know what she had back in Korea. And my mom's sister, my aunt, lived in the States. And so she kind of convinced my mom about better medical facilities here. And I guess, you know, my parents wanted to kind of take a chance of bringing the family over and see if there was a better way of getting whatever it was happening for my sister at the time. They didn't know what she had. And so that was, I think, one was better opportunities, and the other one was maybe better medical facilities for my sister at the time. And so, but we just ended up staying here.
What'd your mom and dad do for a living?
Both of my parents were custodians for a high school. One was for Wydown, one was for Clayton High School. They pretty much got those jobs very, very early on and retired there. So,
and hopefully the following answer is a good one. How's your sister doing?
My sister's good. I mean, obviously she was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy way back in the day, and she gets around. She drives from a wheelchair, so she's doing well. She's a social worker here in St. Louis.
How does one go about learning English, man?
Oh boy, I mean, you know, I think you don't know actually when you first come here that you know that you don't know how to speak the language, but, you know, hanging around with kids and at your age, you just kind of assimilate and you just learn as you go, you know. And so one of the benefits of me retaining, still learning how to speak Korean is because my parents still speak to me in Korean. So I wouldn't say it's great, but I can probably get by with most people.
I love those stories about how people learn watching cartoons and stuff like that. Did that happen with you?
I mean, yeah, for sure. I mean, I would watch, what were some of those things that I would watch? Starsky and Hutch, Ghost Speed Racer, you know, like Tom and Jerry. I mean, those are the things I used to watch when I was a little kid. So yeah, when you watch those things, you, I mean, obviously you naturally would learn as a kid.
Can you imagine if now you were growing up and you were learning English like off of Netflix?
Oh my gosh, yeah. Sure. It's a totally different world we live in now.
Where'd you go to grade school?
I went to Mason. So Mason, all of the kind of magnet schools, and then went to Health Careers High School, which is also a magnet school, and then went to St. Louis University and graduated there.
Did you bring your own lunch?
No, there was a meal program there that that I'd taken advantage of.
Was your mom a big Korean cook?
A huge Korean cook. Yeah, I mean, she still is. I mean, so 2-3 meals a day, every day she'd cook. So
when your friends came over, did she cook American or did she cook Korean?
Oh, she's by far 99% the stuff that she's making is Korean comfort food. I mean, she can make a few things American cuisine wise, burgers, spaghetti, that kind of stuff, but I would say she's mainly a really good home cook.
And yeah. Did your friends enjoy your cooking?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. My friends, I say, and generally speaking, is pretty diverse. I mean, from just diversity of just the Asian countries, whites, blacks. I mean, it's a pretty diverse group of friends that I grew up with and I still have. So they're pretty experimental with food, so it's good.
Yeah, and it's not all about how people reacted to what you had going on with your life. You also were seeing things for the first time. Do you remember being blown away by a couple things the first time you saw them or ate them in the States?
I mean, I think I generally liked American food coming across from Korea. So I would say, I mean, because you just only thing that you know is Korean food growing up. But I remember I enjoyed American food, generally speaking. I did have a funny incident on the plane. Is now there's an abundance of cheese in Korean cuisine. Like they put mozzarella, American cheese on everything now. But when I was in Korea, and what my mom remembers is there was zero cheese. There's no cheese in any Korean cuisine. But I remember coming over to the United States on a plane, they would serve these little cheddar cheese in a little container. And I distinctly remember asking my mom what that was, and she smelled it and said, "Don't eat that." That's all I remember. I remember that story. So that was kind of funny. But now, obviously, I love cheese.
Is there a reason why in Korea they don't have cheese? Is it a, you know, is it a refrigeration thing? Is it a...
It was a... Obviously, I mean, cheese. I mean, the reason why people made cheese back in the day is so that they can make milk products last longer and so forth. But cheese did not exist, as far as what my mom tells me, did not exist in any Korean cuisine back in the days. This is like... you know, 1970s, right? 1970s, mid-1970s, 1980s. And now I think the abundance of just, you know, just with YouTube and social media, I mean, I think people are just traveling a lot more, not recently, obviously, with the COVID, but and the introduction of other types of cuisine integrated into Korean cuisine, and cheese being one of those influencers from European nations, American nations. And so I think there's a lot more of that happening, just you know, fusing of foods happening, not just in Korea, but all over the place and all over the world.
So you graduated from St. Louis University in 95, Bachelor of Science, not restaurant and hospitality.
No, nothing at all. I mean, I knew really nothing about restaurants before I got into the restaurant business, other than knowing what good food tastes like. And I could be a critic of that, but no. Yeah, it just, yeah, I graduated from SLU and, yeah, Bachelor of Science.
What was Club La Boom?
Club Kaboom?
Yes.
So when I, that was my first business. So when I graduated, right when I graduated, I opened up a bar called Club Kaboom over on the Collinsville, Illinois side. And I was barely 21, 22 years old at the time. And so, but I was throwing parties in school, you know, doing just gatherings of people, collecting cover charges, having a band or a DJ. And so I was used to doing promotion. So I decided to get a buddy of mine from college to open up this bar in Collinsville. And it was, you know, for at the time, it was wildly successful. So we were, you know, four nights a week busy and had a lot of fun doing it. And I think I learned a lot of my skill sets in business, just being able to negotiate, cut good deals, and being able to promote a business to be successful. So that's what it was. Really, it was a gathering of people in a place. And at the time, I mean, we don't see clubs like we used to see clubs back in the day now. I mean, I think it's really diminished. And I've actually had several conversations with some friends of mine that's in the industry. And I'm not exactly sure why the entire nightlife and bar industry has kind of diminished in St. Louis, but it has been. But that's how I got started in the business. That was 25, 26 years ago.
You know, when we were growing up, the Landing, where you now have your restaurants, was hot. I mean, Mississippi Nights, you had Sundeckers.
The place to go to for nightlife, actually, you know, the place to go to in terms of nightlife was on the Landing. You know, that was during that time where a lot of people did go out, they socialized, they went to clubs, they went to bars, they go listen to live bands. And we don't have a whole lot of those kind of places in St. Louis anymore for whatever reason. I don't know why, actually. And if anybody knows the answer, please call in.
You know, and I got a brother who's like in his 30s. And when he was growing up, I'd give him the business. Why aren't you out? Why aren't you out with your group? And really, the only thing that group did is they would go to like the Loop or they would go to the West End, but they wouldn't bar hop. They would just kind of hang in one place and then go home.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it's a different generation of people that wants different experiences, obviously. And they don't, you know, back in the 80s, 90s, I mean, people did a lot of drinking, went to bars, doing shots, you know, bombs. But now I feel like it's more crafty. There's more craft cocktails, crafty this beer, crafty that beer. And you drink less of it. And I think the quality of those drinks have gone up as well. So I think it's just a different experience and people want different things now.
So let's fast forward. You open up your first Drunken Fish and you do it in Westport Plaza.
That's correct.
That in the day, I was thinking about it. Remember Casa Gallardo?
Oh, yeah.
Did you know Ray?
I know Ray personally, yeah.
So. And the Funny Bone, when you were there, was the Funny Bone in the plaza or was it outside the plaza off the street?
It was in the plaza. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So we had, obviously we had Casa Gallardo there, Daniel Tools, America's Pub.
Wilbur and Gills.
Wilbur and Gills. That's the spot that I took over. Actually.
Okay.
Wilbur and Gills just went out. I was actually looking at some places in the Central West End where the old 1760, is it 1764? Right across from Shake Shack. Okay. I was looking at that.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? So I was looking at that location to open up my first restaurant. And I couldn't cut a deal there. So ended up hanging out at Westport one day with some friends and saw that old Wilbur and Gills spot, which was also owned by America's Pub at the time, or the people over at America's Pub. And so ended up just a brand new business guy opening up his first restaurant. And that was in 2003.
You know what's funny, and I had totally forgotten this. I worked at KTRS, and so when you opened up, I was there the day you opened up there.
You know? Do you know Gerald De Niro then?
Gerald De Niro?
Joe De Niro.
Oh sure, yeah.
And I knew Joe De Niro from Z1077 when he used to come through Club Kaboom with Boomer and all those guys back when I had my my bar. And and Joe helped me out a lot around that time. I remember when we first opened up, you know, so, and he used to come through all the time. I didn't know you were over there actually.
And I think I probably boy, I know you opened, and I know you were doing great business right off the bat. Yep. My first gig after KTRS was in Salt Lake City running small sports radio stations out there.
Sure.
And so I don't know for sure how long I was there. I know we never met.
Yeah.
But you used to have those big fish bowls?
Yeah.
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 And so when you open up your first restaurant, are you married at the time?
No, not married. I was married to Drunken Fish is what I was. I'm not married now.
Let's talk a little bit about sushi. It's kind of like wine to my template. It's kind of a waste. I don't have the taste for it. But I like it. You know what I mean? It's just, I don't know the difference between a great piece of sushi and David, you should be embarrassed to eat that kind of sushi.
Sure.
But
sure.
I like it. So when I was researching about it, does the name Kawafuko mean anything to you?
Say that again.
Kawafuko. No. Out of Little Tokyo, California, 1966. As the first sushi restaurant in America.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
What was sushi like growing up in St. Louis for you?
Well, for me personally, my dad was a big eater of like raw things. So sashimi, sushi. And I would actually, as a young kid, avoided it and didn't want to actually try it. I probably tried it the first time, maybe the first two or three times. I didn't like it. Just, it was a textural thing for me. And it just didn't taste right in my mouth. But I think probably maybe the fourth, fifth, sixth time eating it, I started to develop I think it's all right. And then somewhere down the line between it's all right, then I started getting cravings for it.
Was there a go-to restaurant for sushi in St. Louis growing up?
I think Tachibana was probably one of the oldest ones in St. Louis. I think there was another place called Pacific Rim over there by Westport Plaza area as well. But yeah, there wasn't a whole lot of places to get sushi in St. Louis back in the early 2000s for sure. When we opened up, there was probably four or five places to get sushi. And then we were probably one of the more modern types or styles of dining options in St. Louis. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why we were popular when we opened up. But I remember though distinctly when we opened, there was a lot of people that would come in and wanting to try it, but they had no idea how to use wasabi, how to use chopsticks, how to order off the menu. So we had to do a lot of training, you know, from the service standpoint to the guests on how to mix the soy sauce with the wasabi, how to order, how many pieces to order. I remember having a lot of conversations with my serving staff about training the guests on how to maneuver through the menu. So that's different now, because now I feel like everybody and their mamas, their kids coming in, eating, using chopsticks. Like it's totally a different world back 17 years ago and now. And there's probably, I don't know, 60, 70, 80 places in St. Louis that serve. If you're not a sushi restaurant, you're serving sushi in some capacity. So the market has significantly increased in terms of there's a lot of places that serve sushi now than there were back when I opened up.
Maybe a stupid question, but when you first opened up, were most of your customers either not from St. Louis or not white?
It was definitely a diverse crowd that came in. And think about Westport back in the day. I mean, all those places that we mentioned earlier, America's Pub, Daniel Tools, Nino's, Trainwreck, Casa Gallardo, Ozzy's was next to us. So Westport was kind of a happening place, you know, much more so than it is now. You know, we had several nightclubs. I mean, we had Margarita Mama's there, America's Pub there. I mean, there's several places where people could hang out as well. So we had a pretty diverse crowd that came in. It wasn't like a predominantly white, predominantly Asian, or predominantly black. It was a good mixture of crowd. You know, I would say that we had maybe a slightly younger demographic in terms of age compared to some of the other places in Westport. But it was a good crowd.
Any major changes in the business model since 2003 to now?
Oh, to now? Like now?
After COVID? Before COVID. Before COVID.
Oh, before COVID. Okay, we're good. Okay, all right. I say before COVID, obviously the menu has developed to what it was before COVID. So we had probably multiple menu changes in the last 16, 17 years. from entrees to sushi to nigiri to rolls. I mean, so the menu has kind of been changing as the times have changed, and people, I think we were probably much more stronger Japanese cuisine in the beginning, even though we had kind of a flary kind of environment or atmosphere, because we had a lot of uni, we had a lot of sashimi on the menu. But now I feel like it's kind of transformed a little bit. There's definitely more fusion items on the menu, and it's continually evolving, obviously, you know, based on not just market trends, but, you know, people's tastes just change in time. So
what does Japanese fusion mean to you?
When you're looking at techniques and Japanese way of cooking and infusing it with either local ingredients or local or American or any other techniques, still keeping the integrity of the idea of Japanese cuisine, but you're partaking other ingredients, local ingredients, into that whole process and coming up with something new. And obviously you can fuse anything, but, you know, you just have to make sure that it tastes good and people like it, you know.
Really stupid question again. How do you get the fresh fish?
You know, people talk about that all the time. It's really, you know, maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, I think that question probably would have been more relevant. But now anybody in the world can get fish from Tsukiji Market in Japan delivered overnight to any city in Kansas, you know, or here in St. Louis. I mean, so it's just I think because of the way trading works and commerce works nowadays globally, you can pretty much, and that's how Amazon works. I mean, Amazon can get products anywhere and get it delivered over to you in the next 24 hours. And so fish works exactly the same way, is that we obviously secure vendors that we're working with on a long-term basis, and we get to pick products that are in season and get it over here relatively out of the waters within 24 to 48 hours into our restaurants. So, and it's not, we don't have a distinct competitive advantage. Every restaurant has the ability to be able to do that as long as they're able to pay for that shipping, you know.
Was there a time with the first Drunken Fish when you were concerned it might not make it?
The first Drunken Fish, we were successful right away for a multitude of reasons. I think we had a very clear, distinctive advantage in terms of the style of sushi that the atmosphere that we were creating at Drunken Fish that was different than the other restaurants in town. And so from really the first month on, it was just a steady pace of business coming through, and it kept increasing the month after month. And so we had a very, and we didn't have social media at the time, obviously. And so, but the word of mouth helped us significantly in the first 6 months. And I think within the 6 months, I just started looking at other places for a second location. So that's when Central West End came about.
Central West End comes about, Laclede Lane comes about, 2015, yep. Man, you kind of got one of those fork in the road moments.
Yeah.
What I read, because I was out in town at the time, the wall of the building crashes.
Yeah.
At the moment, it's not like the landing's hopping. You've got an opportunity to kind of take the easy way out, get the insurance and move on, but you dig your heels in.
I thought about it actually, you know, because I mean, I own the building that I'm in right now, and I bought this building. It's a, you know, 50,000 square foot building on the landing. I bought it in 2006. I renovated it, put a Drunken Fish, put Excess, which is a nightclub, down on the lower level, and we operated Drunken Fish all the way up until the building collapse. And so when that building collapse happened, I was actually, you know, working my normal day in my conference room. And if you look up footages or pictures of that building collapse online on Google, you'll see this dangling conference chair that's hanging off the window. That's my chair. That's the chair that I would normally sit in. But a buddy of mine came to pick me up to grab some lunch, kind of impromptu. And I was like, yeah, let's go grab some lunch. And so I left to go grab some lunch. Within 20 minutes, I get a phone call from one of my managers at Drunken Fish. And he was huffing and puffing about the building collapsed. And I had no idea what he was talking about. I'm like, hey, what are you talking about? What building collapsed? What are you talking about? He goes, our building collapsed. And so obviously I hung up the phone and I had this kind of like, you know, deep breath. And I'm like, hey, let's, I got to head on back. And we march on back. And there was, when I got back within 10 minutes, there was already a sea of people out in the front of the building. And obviously I couldn't see the building collapse, but I saw some smoke on the background, fire trucks, ambulances, bunch of people, hundreds of people outside, you know. And I was just, my heart, I never had my heart pound out of my chest walking up to the building, because I was just afraid, because I had a lot of employees out of my corporate office that was working there at the time. And so I just didn't want anybody hurt. And so obviously I asked around, everybody was safe. And then that moment on, after I found out everybody was safe, nobody was hurt, it was, wow, what the heck what do I do with this thing? And obviously I started making some phone calls about, do I have insurance on the building for something like this? And that's been an ordeal. That was two and a half to three year process of working with the insurance company, getting bids, but with all that's going on, you know, I don't know, you know, usually when you get into an accident, you get a, you know, you have a little fender bender and usually call the insurance and they get it fixed right away. For a multi-million-dollar claim, it's not as easy as people think it is. I mean, it is a process, and they don't give you any answers. They don't give you any answers. And so I was, for a year, it was pretty tough. I mean, just mentally, just figuring out what we needed to do while we're either communicating or not communicating with insurance companies at the time. But yeah, I mean, I think I had a chance to obviously do very minimal work in the building and walk away with the proceeds, because, you know, the landing at the time, a lot of businesses went out, you know, and so there was a lot of nothing going on the landing for many, many years. But you know, I decided to just rebuild there, because I you know, I love the city of St. Louis, and I believe in the neighborhood of the landing, and I think we're making some good strides out here now. So
the buddy that took you out to lunch, does he get like a super special Christmas card every year?
Yeah, for sure.
I've been in your place in Kansas City. How did that come about?
Kansas City came about, I'm sure if you live in St. Louis, you're gonna know, like they talked about Ballpark Village back, you know, I mean, this all happened at Ballpark Village like 5 years ago, but they were talking about Ballpark Village probably like, 11, 12 years ago. So they were talking about Ballpark Village and the whole Ballpark Village back 11 or 12 years ago. And that's how I ended up started talking with the Cordish Group. So Cordish is the landlord that owns, are part owners of Ballpark Village with the Cardinals. And Cordish owns the whole development out in Kansas City in the Power and Light District. And they were reaching out to me about a location in Ballpark Village back 12, 13 years ago. And I just told them that it was just so close to my Drunken Fish on the Landing that I wasn't interested at the time. But they asked me to come out to Kansas City to look at their space out there. And that's how I ended up going out there and making striking a deal up in Kansas City. And that's been open for about 10 years now, 9-10 years.
Is it still your number one gross receipts?
It's Kansas City is definitely, I would say that one. And yeah, I would say that's probably my number one store in terms of sales.
And then in regards to Ballpark Village, I would imagine that was fun because you got to build it from scratch.
Yeah, that was a ground up construction. So there was nothing in there. So that, yeah, we were able to design it the way we wanted it. So that was a fun project.
Have they given you any idea, any suggestions on when that thing's opening back up?
I mean, they gave me some tentative dates in July, but they're still in open discussions on when everything's going to open up because of this COVID situation. So we're just talking every week about it, but they tentatively said sometime in July.
So we're going to get into COVID a little bit. I've tried not to get into it because the great thing about podcasts is they're perpetual. And so people are going to be listening to these things 5 years from now, hopefully anyway, 5 years from now. And I don't want, you know, all these episodes to be 48% about COVID. But when it comes to restaurants, I think we need to talk about it. My first unfair question was, prior to COVID, you're on record as saying, you know, the goal maybe would be 50 locations across the country. Mm-hmm. Is that still a thing that you would hope for?
I think so. I think that's one of the things that we've always, that's the vision for our company, is to get the 50 units. I mean, obviously there's some challenges right now with the COVID situation and we're changing our business model, but you know, we're not just Drunken Fish anymore. I mean, we're eventually going to scale Kimchi Guys, which is the fast casual, that you dine at, yesterday or, and we have an event spaces as well. But I mean, I think in terms of restaurant brand Drunken Fish, yes, we want to scale that. You know, I think 50 would be a great number to hit. And being able to multiply that and expand that with Kimchi Guys would be our ultimate goal as a hospitality company.
Feel free to tell me why this is a stupid idea. So you've got a lot of restaurants now. They can only be at 25. They can only be at 50% capacity. For ones like yourself in Westport, do you ever envision kind of like an outdoor food court where I can get something from you and I can get a taco from Fuzzy and I could pick up a sandwich from Trainwreck? And use that whole area as kind of an outdoor, is that just a horrible idea?
No, I mean, the idea of food halls, like what you're mentioning, it's been a very, very popular dining trend across the country and around the world. And that trend of dining has been multiplying. And I think, obviously, going to one place and being able to have options for multiple different types of cuisines is kind of like what the millennials want and younger generations want. And so, you know, I don't think that's a horrible idea. I think there are places like the Foundry, the City Foundry is trying to capitalize on those types of dining options, you know? So yeah, I think that's not a horrible idea, you know, in an existing area like Westport and trying to make it into a food hall, that might be a little bit more of a harder, challenging logistic to make that happen. But creating something from scratch, like multiple venues in a hall situation, I think that's a dining trend that's gonna keep going.
Food trucks gonna stick around?
I think the food truck's gonna stick around as well, you know, but yeah, food trucks, not as popular as it has been, but I think food hall will be significantly higher in terms of interest, and we might get one, two, or three of those in St. Louis in the next, you know, 2 to 3 years, I would say so. And then obviously takeout business, delivery business, with delivery services, I think are going to increase as well. So, and as a restaurant owner and operator, I think people in our industry has to understand those kind of trends and being able to adjust to those trends, because if you don't, then you will not exist in the marketplace.
So you mentioned Kimchi Guys. Did I pronounce that correct? Kimchi?
Kimchi Guys.
Thank you. Kimchi Guys. So, like, my palate cannot decipher from good, bad sushi. Oh, uh-huh. I know a good wing and I know a bad wing. I got up this morning. I wanted to swing by and taste the wings myself and have an idea of what I was talking about.
Sure.
They're phenomenal. They're fantastic.
Thank you.
Is it the double cooking? I mean, what makes them the way that they are?
I think some of the distinct features of Korean fried chicken over what we are used to here in the States as Southern fried chicken is really a couple things. One is the batter. The batter is not, you know, flour based. It's usually a starch based batter. We brine our meat just like, you know, Southern fried chicken as well. Then we have a double fry process. So you fry it one time with the batter at a lower temperature, and it goes to a higher temperature to get the outside crispy. And really the science behind it is, how do you keep the meat moist, but also keep the crunchiness on the outside? And the last thing that's really distinct about Korean fried chicken is it's always accompanied by some sauce on the outside. So yeah, batter, cooking temperatures, two different ways, and a sauce that accompanies the fried chicken. So those are the things that I think distinctly is different.
I had the spicy original and I had the Korean buffalo, which were both excellent. The rice was good too, the fried rice.
Oh, okay.
That's good too.
Kimchi fried rice.
Korean food in general, and excuse my ignorance, but
sure,
it has something to do with food and medicine are very intertwined. Can you explain that to me?
Well, I think Korean cuisine in general, from when talking about traditionally, it came about in harder times in Korea. So a lot of the pickling that's happened is about preservation of food. A lot of the side plates that have come about is from preservation of food and eating healthy in conjunction with your body. So there's a lot of vegetables usually in Korean cuisine. And so a lot of mountain vegetables, a lot of, you know, just a lot of vegetables in general. And so, yeah, it's supposed to be kind of harmonious with eating healthy and having a good balanced diet on a day-to-day basis.
Fermentation in the United States, is that harder to pull off?
Excuse me?
Fermentation of all the vegetables and all the foods and stuff?
I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, you can pretty much ferment a lot of things. It not just preserves food, but it partakes flavor into whatever that it is that you're fermenting. You know, kimchi is probably the number one recognizable fermented product coming out of Korea. And it is that fermentation process that partakes flavor into the vegetable and it makes it healthier. And it is getting more and more popular, not just here in St. Louis, but also globally. And so I think Korean cuisine in itself, not just through just kimchi, but the cuisine itself is growing. First time that I've noticed since I've been not just living here in St. Louis, but people are wanting to get more Korean options here. So,
are you a fan of David Chang?
For sure, yeah. Yeah, David Chang.
When I watch that show, it's not so much that I'm learning as much as I'm like, hey, that's kind of neat. I never really thought about it that way.
Yeah. I think when you're, you know, you mentioned David Chang, but there's so many, like, because of social media and because of YouTube, I think it's definitely broadening the horizon for most people in terms of what they have eaten as they grew up, as they were growing up. And watching YouTube and watching, you know, Travel Network and just seeing culturally what's out there, I think more people are interested in trying new things and trying new experiences, in turn also trying new cuisines, you know? And so I think that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing around the world.
Couple movies I've enjoyed there about cooking. Did you ever see the movie Chef with Jon Favreau?
I did, yeah.
What'd you think of that? Was it true? Was it not?
I think it was a good movie in itself. I think Roy Choi, who is the kind of the inventor or creator of the food truck movement, and he's a Korean guy that really put Korean tacos and burritos and marrying Korean and Mexican food together. We talked about fusion back earlier in our discussion, but yeah, he's the guy that really fused those two cuisines together and came up with the kind of a Korean-Mexican fusion style of food in his food truck. And obviously he was in the movie, but he was the one that kind of consulted with that whole process.
He's got that scene where they're making that grilled cheese.
Yeah.
How intense you have to be about a grilled cheese.
Yeah, it is true. It is true. Yeah.
Now, do you cook still?
I enjoy cooking. Yeah, I enjoy cooking. Yeah.
What do you like to cook? Let's take Korean off the plate, because obviously we know that. Outside of Korean food, what do you like to cook?
I mean, I can pretty much cook anything. But let's say last week I cooked a steak and potatoes, spaghetti. So those are the two things that I cooked over the weekend.
Did you see the movie Burnt with Bradley Cooper?
I haven't seen that one. No, I haven't seen that one.
I don't think that one's as real as the chef one. But the one thing that is interesting, and this is probably back in the day stories, it was really hard to own a restaurant and not be an alcoholic. Was that ever a problem or an issue with either you or your friends?
No, I mean, I can tell you right now, the culture of the kitchen is I mean, people don't understand what it takes to work in a kitchen, you know? And I think, and the people that work in the kitchen has very distinct personalities. And so, and then people that maybe dine at restaurants, have never been in the kitchen or don't know people who are chefs or work as a sous chef or people who work regularly in the kitchen for multiple number of years. Yeah, there's a little bit of function, a little bit of dysfunction that goes along with it. And you have to be a little bit of a crazy guy to be able to be in the kitchen for a long period of time, because it's organized chaos in there.
Is the camaraderie part of the fun?
I think camaraderie is always part of the fun. Yeah, I think that's why I do it. You know, so it's I love working with the people that are here with me, and and just even in my office now. I'm not in the restaurants as much as I used to when I was first starting out, but I still have my team in the corporate office. We have about a dozen people here that, you know, some of them have been with me since day one, but multiple people have been with me over, you know, 10, 14 years, you know. So I think that's the fun part for me, is being around some wonderful people that has helped me grow, and vice versa, you know, help them grow. So,
all right. So let's unfortunately talk about COVID for a little bit. Your location in Westport, how are you setting the tables up? How's it all look?
So right now, if you come in, you're going to get your temperature checked. Everybody that's working at Drunken Fish right now will have masks on and have gloves on. There's sanitation practices and protocols that are set in place in terms of cleaning surfaces that are touched multiple times, and we're cleaning those surfaces on an hour-to-hour basis. We're seating guests, obviously socially distanced, 6 feet apart or more, and we have a contactless way of ordering. So we had to figure out a way to get people information about the menu pricing without using physical menus. So right now you would just get on your phone, mobile phone, Apple, Android, whatever it is, you would scan a QR code. That QR code is mapped out to that specific table. So you would get on that, you would just scan that QR code, menu will pop up with pictures, place your orders, make your payments. As soon as you hit your payment and cash out that payment, or finish out that payment, the order gets placed in the kitchen, and a service team member will bring the food and or drinks out to your table. So it's a complete contactless environment. And we made it that way, not just for the safety of our employees, but also for our guests that are coming through. And to be honest with you, I don't know if any other restaurants are doing it that way. I know there's restaurants that are, you know, scanning a QR code, you're seeing a menu, then you're still placing an order through the servers that are really, really close by. But you can come into Drunken Fish, not see any servers around you, complete the transaction, get food to your tables without having any interactions. And I kind of really like that model, maybe even past the COVID situation, because you control the dining experience in terms of ordering in the palm of your hands. And there's a lot of times where you would go eat and dine out at restaurants when you're waiting for a server to get you the bill. And one of the benefits of this is that you don't have to wait for a server. You can make the payments, and whenever you're ready to leave, you can leave. And so another time is when you get sad and you want to order an appetizer or a drink, you would have to wait for a server to come to your table. In this situation also, you can sit down and place an order for an appetizer or a drink or a couple of cocktails or whatever it is, whenever you are. And so we put the control in the hands of diners, when they want to order it, how they want to order it, how often they want to order it, and leave when they want. And even though this was brought about based on the COVID situation, but I still think this model works really, really well after the COVID situation. And so we're adopting this model at all the Drunken Fish restaurants, and we're trying to implement this at Kimchi Guys as well. So it's all contactless.
Now, I work with a lot of restaurants in my normal job, and one of the things that people smarter than I have mentioned is that after we do get through COVID, hopefully sooner than later, you might see like almost half a restaurant be COVID-esque and the other half be the way it used to be. Is that something you could foresee happening?
I mean, I think it's very interesting. And a lot of the dialogues that we're having is, what is this model going to look like? Obviously, there's some hybrid model that we're trying to work in place because of the situation. And obviously safety is our highest thing that we're talking about. But we also think about after COVID, what is the model that's going to work for most diners, you know? And so I love the convenience idea of taking a phone, going into the restaurant of my choice, being able to order when I want without waiting for a server. Like, I love that idea of the convenience that I control. It's kind of this analogy that I gave to my team is, you know, and you might remember this. Like, I remember when Chinook's first came out with the self-checkout line. And I remember for months, nobody would go into those lines because they just didn't know anything about it. And I remember just going, man, I wonder why they did that. They spent all this money on all these self-checkout lines and it's never being used, you know? And if you go today to any Schnucks or Deerbergs or even Sam's Club or Costco, you see those self-checkout lines being used a lot. And I think it's kind of that style is, I think, where fast casual kind of wins out a little bit. It makes it fast and convenient for the diners. And when you make it fast and convenient for the diners ultimately will win out. And I think even with casual dining experiences, kind of like, you know, the Cheesecake Factories of the world or your favorite restaurant or Italian restaurant, if you can put the control into the hands of the diners on when they can order, I think this model will stay past the COVID situation. Because once they get used to ordering that way, you're not going to be able to go back once COVID situation ends. So I just kind of feel that that's what's going to happen, is that obviously all of this entire process has changed because of COVID. But I think this model of convenience to the diners and contactless, pay when you want, order when you want, will continue to be there after the situation ends with COVID.
What percent of your business is down year to date from last year?
That first week was so scary, because when the lockdown came down, boy, that first week was, we went from doing whatever that dollar amount was to doing about 15% of that first week. And so, I'm sure it wasn't just me, it was probably all across the city, all across the state and in the country. But now I feel like we're very close to doing what we did last year, and there are certain days we're doing more. And I think it's because the last 3 weeks we had started serving people in the dining rooms now. So we went from about 10 to 15% takeout model to 100% takeout model over a few week time period. And now we're getting that some of those dine-in customers back with a very, very strong takeout model still in existence. And so we're very close to having the same numbers, if not better numbers, than last year.
Turning lemon into lemonades, walk me through how restaurants and charities have gotten together to feed the first responders or feed the homeless. And I never remember that being as prevalent, and hopefully that's something that sticks around after we get everybody healthy.
For us, and I can't talk to, I think, other restaurants and other restaurant groups. For us, I thought it was really important for us to give back, especially during the times where I felt the need, especially with the first responders that are going out of their way, taking care of the people here locally and in our community. So we made an effort, even with a very limited team going into this COVID situation, that, hey, if there's a way for us to be able to give back to the community that we serve. And so one charity that we wanted to give back to or help out was our own industry, our hospitality industry. So we were giving away food for 8 weeks straight for anybody who worked in the hospitality industry. Every Tuesday at Kimchi Guys with a free meal. And then we did it at Drunken Fish Central West End every Thursday for anybody who worked in the hospital industry. That if you're a nurse, if you're in a hospital, if you work in the ER, if you're a doctor, a nurse, whoever it is, we were going to give away free sushi meals every Thursday. So we were doing it twice a week. No questions asked in terms of that. And we were able to feel like we were participating in all the chaos that's been going on with this COVID situation and giving back to our community. And I want to do more of that even past or post COVID situation as well. So
what percent of your business is the delivery system companies, and what percent do you think it'll be next year?
Right now, we're probably still about 75% deliveries and takeout business model. And about 25% dine-in, because this is going on our third week in terms of dine-in. And so we're about 75-25. I think that model will continually go down, meaning we'll end up doing less and less takeout as more and more diners come in. And I think it'll end somewhere flip-flop. I mean, we went from maybe 10 to 15% takeout model before this COVID situation, and I bet you we'll probably end up being about 70 to 75% dine-in and about 25 to 30% takeout. And I think that's going to be the model for the future, because we already knew that the delivery and takeout model was going to increase even before this COVID situation hit, because people want the convenience of their food being delivered to their homes and being able to eat when they want and, you know, in whatever clothing that they want while they're watching their Netflix when they want. And I think the model of the convenience was increasing, and that's the kind of the direction that we were seeing all along prior to COVID. And so, at the end of this situation, I feel that it's going to be about 70-30.
See, in personal consumer feedback, what had your wings today? I live in West County, but the delivery service is going to have me be a customer of yours much more often than when there wasn't a delivery system, because I just don't get downtown. You know, dude, I'm 50 plus. I got three kids. I'm not getting downtown if I don't have a ticket. But your wings are good enough that, I mean, I'm gonna have them, more than a few more times, because now, unlike 5 years ago, delivery is in my, way of doing things.
Yep. And I think that's one of the reasons why delivery services in general has done a really good job promoting to the consumers. And I think when it comes to convenience, that's where it's going to win out. I think when customers can get their favorite food from their favorite restaurants and to get it in the convenience of their own home, that model to me is going to increase, And so, we plan on it. We went from 10 to 15, and we plan on doubling that percentage somewhere down in the near future. So
you just entered into the fast food, not fast food, but what did you call it again? It was
fast casual.
Is there another arena that you're going to be getting into as you get closer to those 50 locations?
I mean, I think one of the obviously, when it comes to expansion or scaling, I think Kimchi Guys is, I think we're ready probably in the next 6 months or so to be able to put a Kimchi Guys in another location outside of the Landing. And so I'm actually starting some of those kind of conversations now. I don't know if it's going to be at Westport or if it's going to be down in the Loop or if it's going to be, in the West End, but I want to put another location of Kimchi Guys as a secondary unit somewhere in the city, somewhere in the county, somewhere as a second location.
Well, you've been very kind with your time. You are very nice about my mispronunciations of things. When you look at the importance St. Louis has, and we'll go through this a little bit when we do the St. Louis 7, but, as you continue to expand, what is it that you're trying to communicate to the St. Louis people about the food that you're bringing to them and the meals that you're providing for them that maybe they're not accustomed to?
Well, I think people talk about, authenticity a lot. People talk about fusion foods a lot. People talk about this or that, or, stay true to this. For me, it's always about just trying to create dishes that taste good. And I think when it talks to your tongue, it's the kind of decision that we want to make as a company is that, hey, listen, we never claim to be the favorite Korean restaurant or the favorite sushi restaurant. The best Korean restaurant or the best sushi restaurant. We just want to make sure that we have people that love our food for whatever it is, And so I think what we're trying to do as a hospitality company is to create good products that people feel like they're getting a good value. They, want to come back and get those items again and put a smile on their faces, And so, we want to be their, their neighborhood favorite restaurant for sushi or for Korean fried chicken or for their favorite event space to do their weddings. I mean, we just want to be their favorites,
Well, I'm glad to hear that business isn't as bad as you've heard it at other places. I think that is a testament to the food that you provide and flexibility you have with dealing with things. Let's get this vaccine and take the good things from what we learned, but do away with the rest and go back to what we like doing.
I agree. I agree for sure.
I had a good time. Hope you did too.
Thank you very much for having me. That was fun talking with you.
And there you have it. Another one for the books. Enjoyed it. Hope you did too. Don't forget, if you like what you're hearing, hit that little subscribe button. If you would do that for me, that's a big favor. It gets me in front of more ears. Looking forward to next week's episode with Jim Thomas of the Post-Dispatch. Talked about Missouri. Talked about the Rams. Had a good time. If you have anything that you want to drop in as a suggestion for future episodes, otwitholiver@gmail.com. And if not, as we do, thanks for your time this time. Till next time, so long.